Hi everyone. I have the pleasure today of presenting to you an interview conducted on the telephone with Mr. Devinder Sharma of India. He is a distinguished food and trade policy analyst and an award-winning Indian journalist, writer and thinker, well-known and respected for his views and views on food and trade policies mostly. Trained as an agricultural scientist, and he holds a master's in plant and breeding and genetics. Mr. Sharma has been with the Indian Express for the first 10 years of his working career. And during that time, one of his assignments, as he told me, was to spend months into remote corners of India, and so that when he came back, he could write about the issues, not from a city dweller's point of view who just spent a few hours there, but from the point of view of the locals. And this 10 years had given him a solid background, which probably was not to be repeated again because newspapers stopped doing that kind of thing since then, more or less. Mr. Sharma had just returned from an international convention on farmers' rights in Geneva, conducted by the United Nations. And then when he was back in India, I caught him on telephone for this interview. And my first question to him was what he thought about the Western technology and high-tech industrial input-intensive models that was being pushed down everybody else's throat as a solution to world hunger, as a technological solution to real-life problems. What did he think about this?
Well, let me be very honest on this issue. You know, when I was studying agriculture, undergraduate and postgraduate both, I was, of course, like as I normally say, I was also part of the same programming that is done to make us believe that, you know, Indian agriculture is backward, substandard and inefficient. And if we have to really pull out Indian agriculture from the crisis that it is faced with, then we have to follow the Western model of agriculture. And in my graduation and post-graduation, this is the impression that I also carried, and I don't deny that. In fact, you know, the more you study agriculture as part of the curriculum, the more you realize that the only reason why the Indian farmers were not doing good was because they were not adopting the newer technology that was coming in and the universities were trying to develop. And that is the reason why, you know, the crisis on agriculture front. And the more I think I see that happening across the country, not only with me, but I think all of us who pass out from agriculture universities, by and large, I think there might be hardly an exception, where people are, as I said earlier, are programmed. You know, this is basically a programming being done for the generation. So generation after generation which have come out from the agriculture university come out with this belief, and I was no exception, that, you know, lab to land is the only way forward. You know, what we are developing the laboratories, and when we take it to the farm, then only the real progress in agriculture can happen.
And here this is Tony Mitra back again. I have been editing this conversation for the last 1 month and often have to go back and rethink some of the things that Mr. Sharma said and had to go and study again. What he just said here, it rings bell in so many different ways. One of the root problems of India's hunger or agricultural output is the very mindset and the education system in India itself. The more you try to solve problems and then you try to study the subject, which is the right way to go about it, you learn the wrong things from the wrong place, which doesn't suit Indian conditions. It is not economically the right plan to hand over your independence to a patent-holding foreign corporation. But forget that. Even the point of view of sustainability, what is really produces maximum healthy output with minimum input, and which keeps the soil healthy, which employs a lot of people, which gives them financial security and probably a better life than their parents, this doesn't happen. And the country and the institutions will continue to push the wrong policy because they have been trained to think that the only solution to India's food scarcity is to follow the West. There is no room to even think that there may not be a scarcity. The problem of hunger may be related to the way pricing is fixed rather than availability of food and how, the way middlemen are making money. So one of the basic fundamental problem in India is the very way we are tuning our education system to ape the West. It doesn't work. There were enough original thinkers in India who could realize that. There are enough original thinkers in India today who realize that. But they are minority. Nobody wants to listen to them. It's all either coming from United States or it's all garbage. Anyhow, back to Mr. Devinder Sharma.
So, but I guess the change that I witnessed was because I became a journalist, and when I became a journalist at the Indian Express, which was the largest selling newspaper at that time, and since I was responsible for agriculture for the entire country, it provided me the right kind of opportunity and the investment made by Indian Express to see that I travel across the country, spend time understanding what is happening, and then I write my articles. And that made me travel and open my eyes. And I think those 10 years in Indian Express were a complete, I would say, reason for the transformation in my thinking and approach.
Oh, wonderful. And which 10 years were they?
I joined Indian Express in 1981 and left them in 1991. So these 10 years I thought were the most crucial. In fact, I must admit that I was very lucky to be at the right place at the right time, because if you see around, you know, those of us who graduate from agriculture universities or from any other university for that matter, have no inkling, have no connect with the realities in the countryside. And we somehow, our entire education depends on the computer terminal.
Here we come across another classic case. The answers to all problems are sought at the computer terminal. Computers are supposed to solve problems, not people. Reality on the soil is not important. Reality on the ground is not important. What comes out of a freaking screen that is programmed somewhere in the high-tech end of some country somewhere is supposed to be the new mantra, the new holy grail of Trinity that is supposed to take us through the threshold of eternal happiness. Anyway, back to Devinder Sharma.
And we form our opinion, we form our ideas, or we form our future thinking based on what is researched. And that is what is available to us. Now, Indian Express gave me an opportunity to travel extensively. And again, let me give you an example. They wanted me, at one time, my editor wanted me to do a story on dry land agriculture. Now, we all know 60% of India's area is dry land, rain-fed, you know, dependent upon rains. And the one way of doing it is what we do it now. I find if one has to do a report on dry land agriculture, then you look into the internet, look into some more research material here and there, and then you talk to four people, give their quotes, and your story is over. But in my case, I was made to travel into the dry land regions of India for 3 months. And I traveled extensively for 3 months. I drew up my own itinerary, met wherever I, the officials, the university scientists, the international scientists, everyone concerned, including the farmers. So I drew up my itinerary, and when I was ready, I went to my nearest, because Indian Express was a multi-edition newspaper. So I went to my nearest center and filed my report, which was carried all over the country. Now that, I think, investment that Indian Express made is the real reason. Lots of people have asked me why you know, I look at agriculture from a different perspective. Is because of those 10 years, which actually were, I would say, the real education that I got.
Oh, that's wonderful. And how did Indian Express, I mean, this is a watershed event. So how did Indian Express, which is, after all, also a business house, manage to make this investment thinking that it would be not necessarily good for Indian agriculture, but good for the news media. How did they come to this remarkable decision?
I think, first of all, let's understand that I'm talking of a period when newspapers were not a commodity. And I'm talking of a period when newspapers were being, or let's say when, you know, the newspaper medium, I would say, was part of a passion or mission or, you know, a kind of responsibility they had undertaken to bring the social issues up or to be voice of the country. Now, Indian Express appointed me as the agriculture correspondent. I was the third agriculture scientist in India to have joined Indian journalism, and I remain the last. After that, I don't think any agriculture scientist has joined the Indian newspapers. The point I'm trying to make here is that was the idea at that time of Indian Express was that, you know, here is a country which is basically agricultural, and we don't have any kind of a, you know, connect, or we don't get to know what is happening in agriculture. So they brought me in, and the idea was that I travel across the country and write about the, you know, various aspects, various problems, various issues, and so on and so forth. And that, I think, was the right investment, as I said, personally also for me, because that opened up my eyes, it opened up my thinking, it opened up my vistas and viewpoint about agriculture, because the hair was a ground reality that I was, let's say, staring at. And after that, I think the era of commodification of news began, and newspapers stopped doing that. And nowadays, we have, as you know, even district edition has been brought out. All newspapers have a district edition. So, you know, one district correspondent does not go to another area now. So earlier it was Punjab correspondent would not go to Haryana, for instance, because Haryana has another correspondent. But now that line has, narrowed down to districts even. So All I'm saying is I was lucky to be at the right time and right place, because I had the entire country as my beat. And I think that kind of education should happen anywhere. But if you look at multinational, people who work at multinationals, people who work in the media, people who work in the policy making, I think none of them, or no organization which appoints them, actually is investing them to go out and see for themselves. And I think that is the reason why there is a global crisis today. It's happening not only in India, it's happening everywhere in the world. And that is the reason why there is a massive, massive disconnect between the ground realities and the kind of policy planning that is happening.
Mm, absolutely. It reminds me, your talk reminded me of a bit of history where Gandhi, after he returned to India from South Africa, decided to spend 2 years roaming the country's rural India before he decided to get back to the cities for politics. So
I think what you are saying is very important. I never visualized in that context. But I think those 10 years that I was made to travel extensively in the country, and was not only education for me, but also I think it made me understand what India is all about. And because I look into the political economy of the entire issue, I think it becomes very handy to then place what is happening today globally, or what was happening a few years earlier or over the years, into the context of whether it is going to be people-centric, whether it's going to be environment-friendly, or whether it's going to be really helping the nation to emerge out of the kind of crisis that it is getting deeper and deeper into. I think that now I realize when you say this, that, of course, one can't equate with Gandhi, but I think in that 10 years, the kind of travels that I made within the country was really an eye-opener. And I think the basic education that I had in agriculture in the university and then getting into the field, that combination, I think, became deadly, as somebody has written about me somewhere, that in the entire debate on intellectual property rights, Devendra Sharma's views stand out, in a different perspective, or brings out a different perspective, because they have been asking me why and how. But I think this was the specific reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I will jump one of the questions to go to the third one, and that is because of what you just told me. And I go back to some old writings of exchanges and writings between Tagore and Gandhi, and I think you'll find it very relevant, and I'll ask your take on it on today's perspective. And that subject of correspondence and writing was Tagore making a statement, an observation, that the economic relationship between the urban India, and I'm talking about 100 years ago, not today, economic relation between urban India and rural India has denigrated, gone bad, so bad that today it is a relationship of exploitation and not a harmonious give and take. So today the cities exploit the rural India, and as long as rural India remains exploited, you can forget about pushing the British out and getting invaded. It will make no difference. India will have to find a solution to bring an equitable relationship between the rural. Do you think this is still a problem that India is not only solving, but probably made it worse?
Well, this kind of exploitation, which I think Tagore and Gandhi talked about, is got more pervasive now and has become more problematic now. Because it is true, and I think I admire them for having pointed out much earlier in history, but the fact remains that, in India's context, we're talking about the urban areas or the urban people exploiting the poor in the villages and the rural areas. But I think if you look at the global situation also, the rich countries have exploited the poor countries. And, as I have always been saying, every country has a north, every country has a south. Right. The north, I mean, they are the rich, and the south is the poor, which is the majority in almost all parts of the world. Now, the north has been exploiting the south, and whether it is in America, Canada, or Europe. And similarly, in India, the north is basically centered is a power center in the urban areas. And they have been exploiting. And this exploitation has increased over the years. And today, we have an economic structure which actually thrives or lives on exploitation of the poor. Earlier, the exploitation of the poor was in terms of extracting the finances out of the villages. But today the exploitation has gone a step ahead. It is now extracting the natural resources from the villages. So now, and that was the era, I would say, from 1980s to about 2000, when we were exploiting the natural resources of the rural areas or the countryside. Now we have gone a step ahead. We are not only exploiting natural resources, we are not taking control over the natural resources, and we are trying to push the poor people out of these villages. So I think it's if you see the three stages that I talked about, one was what Gandhi and Tagore talked about. And then, of course, post-independence, we had this situation when people were trying to exploit the natural resources base of the countryside, and now we are at a stage when we are grabbing those natural resources, monopolizing those natural resources, and also ensuring that the people who are in control of it, and talk of the communities and so on, or the tribal communities, the rates and whatever, have to be pushed out of those areas. So this is a kind of a change that I see, and I'm sure you'll agree that my thinking is that this is going to be more frightening and more dangerous, a kind of a decline that we are witnessing today.
Mm-hmm. It's a very grim situation. So I'll go back to the second question, Mr. Sharma, that is, mm-hmm. India's biological diversity and biomass richness, how would you say, richness both natural as well as those that are induced by farmers over the last 10-15,000 years, how vast would you say this as a capital compared to many other countries, and how deep is the degradation of it that is happening?
Well, I think the best way to understand this would be to compare the two biggest democracies, United States of America and India. Columbus sailed to discover, by default when he discovered America, there were about hundreds of species there. But subsequently it was found out that America is home to only 5 plant species and 3 animal species. Which means the biodiversity that originates from within America, which America can lay claim on, under the IPR regime today, I think there are only 5 plant species, and the most important plant species is safflower. In among the animal species, they have got only three animal species, about which of which the most important is soy. Now, you will agree that you cannot build a superpower on five plant species and three animal species. Now, compare this with the situation in India. As the Russian scientist Mevlov had sometimes back when he was alive, discovered or pointed out, there were seven regions of biodiversity hotspots in the world, which has now been expanded to 14 or to more than that. India was one of them, the subcontinent. And just to give you the enormity of the kind of biodiversity wealth that we have, being a tropical and subtropical country, India is having 51,000 plant species. And when I say 51,000 plant species, let's say rice is only one of the species, but it may have hundreds and thousands of variants or accessions or varieties, but it's counted as one. Now, 51,000 plant species, and it has 81,000 animal species. Now, out of the 51,000 plant species that India has, the one that belongs to us or originate from within India, like I said about America, the five plant species that originate from America. India has 7,000 plant species that originate from within the country. So it you can see the kind of wealth or the biodiversity, biological wealth that India has. In case of animal species, out of the 81,000 animal species existing in India, which includes lower forms of life also, 5,000 plant species originate from India. I had asked this to the Geological Survey of India recently, and they gave me the figure, 5,000 plant species, animal species, originate from within the country. And compare that to America, there were only three animal species originate from within America. So I think it tells you what exactly is the kind of situation as compared to the importance of biological wealth for a nation's development. Now, America knew that it doesn't have plant resources or the genetic wealth. So what they did was, and I've written a lot about it, they actually tried to collect. Conserve, bring about illegally or illegally from across the world all the plant species. So it is a different matter that today the largest collection of plant biodiversity in the public sector, which is about 700,000 plant species, is actually stocked with the U.S. Department of Agriculture at Fort Knox and Fort Collins. Now, this is the largest collection the world has. Imagine a country which had only five plant species, today has control over 700,000 plant species. Now, that's the way the political economy of biological wealth has, shifted the balance to United States of America. Now, people in India, people or globally do not realize that under the Convention on Biological Diversity, which was signed in 1992, plant genetic resources are no longer mankind's heritage. It's a national sovereign resource. Now, what exactly exists in India, which originates from India, is India's resource. India has control over it. But the collections that America has got, 700,000, as I said, are outside the purview of this declaration. So, which means America is de facto or by default controlling the biggest collection. And that is what is driving the entire American industry growth, because that is where the biotechnology comes in, that's where the patenting regime comes in, that's where the industrial products comes in, and that's the raw material which they've got free of cost. And that has been taken from the developing countries. Now, interestingly, when they got these plant species, they actually didn't know what to do with them. Because, if you start analyzing each plant, doing the characterization, it will take you ages and take you a whole lot of money to analyze what it is good for. So the best thing is to go to those communities which live with those plant species. And then, this is, and to know from them what they were trying to use these plant species for, which is a term which is for that is called traditional knowledge. So they actually came back to us and told us that traditional knowledge is mankind's heritage, but most of it is verbal, oral, so therefore it must be documented. So we have all been documenting for the benefit of the industry in the West. So now first they got the raw material, now they are also getting the traditional knowledge associated with it. Now they are developing products based on the traditional knowledge, and then they are drawing intellectual property rights on it and selling it back to India or to other developing countries. So I think this is the development model that exists today, and I think we need to understand where we have lost that opportunity and where we have simply got into a trap and followed what exactly the West wanted us to do, and we go about doing what they want to do.
And with that, we shall come to the end of the first part of the interview. I realize that the interview is so important and it's covers so much of ground that it was hard to keep it all in one episode, and I decided eventually to break it down into a number of them. So this is the first part, and here we cover already a lot of ground. Mr. Sharma starts out by talking about the way he got his education, and there itself lied the one of the fundamental problems of not just Indian agriculture, but essentially the whole world. I mean, sitting here in Canada, I can't say that Canada is doing any better. In fact, probably doing much worse. So it's a global problem where excessively high dependence on technology, as if it is the panacea that can solve all problems, without thinking that technology comes with a nasty dark side of it. First part of it is corporate driven, and where profit might be the main goal, not necessarily improvement of the situation, of the ecology, of the environment, or the food supply. Sometimes it is driven by profit, and people are given the wrong impression, carefully crafted impression, that it is also good for the people otherwise. Not just that the corporations make money, but it'll be good for people, good for environment, good for everybody, and so on. That's not always the case. That's rarely the case, in fact. So that was the first lesson. And then we had many other things. For instance, the exploitation of urban cultures, not just in India, but everywhere, over the rural, and the denigration of the rural society, especially in the south or in the developing countries. So much so that the villagers and the farmers are so poor, they make so little money that essentially it's like a master and servant relationship. And this was realized by Tagore and highlighted in his writings, which were also subjects of discussion with Gandhi. But as Mr. Sharma said, this exploitation has only gotten worse. It has not become any better, and not just for India. So this was the second point. The third point raised by Mr. Sharma, which was very relevant, and that is a new kind of exploitation. Initially, it was just the labor and the efforts of the rural communities that were being exploited by the urban. And now, even the natural resources that lie under their feet, and even the very land that they have been owning or having rights to for generations, for millennia, are being taken away in the name of corporate development. So this is a new kind of exploitation that is sweeping across the world, and India is no exception. The next point covered was the issue of biological diversity, how rich or poor different continents are, where India stands as far as the God-given, nature-given diversity of the place, and how much of it is already stolen or being stolen, and how the Biological Preservation Act, Biodiversity Preservation Act, and so on came to be, but how the data and the samples held in United States is outside of the purview of that, and how nations are stealing other nations' natural biological diversity and claiming a right to put a patent on it, and so on. How all that is being done with the knowledge and even essential help from the people from those countries. They are the ones who are giving the samples away, and they are the ones who are writing what those plants are good for, and they are the ones who are providing the labor so that somebody else can enjoy the rights of ownership of such life forms. And this is happening under the very eyes of upwardly mobile corporate India, which is playing a very important role in ensuring that the property is transferred across to overseas nations. And this was another item that is very well explained by Mr. Devinder Sharma. And of course, this is happening not just to India, this is happening to every country. You have to replace India with Guatemala, with Canada, with just name it, you know, Vietnam, South America, I mean, Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, just name it. It's happening everywhere. Another critical issue we didn't cover, but Mr. Devinder Sharma did, was the changing role of the media. He entered service at a time when media still had some sense of social responsibility, their duty towards the society to highlight certain things and so on, and not let the world be defined by people sitting in their air-conditioning tall buildings in cities. And he was one of the last generation to have benefited from that, where media actually helped him go learn the countryside. That's not being done anymore anywhere. And the mainstream media has also abdicated its traditional age-old duty. So a lot of ground was covered in this short talk. And I thought this would be a good time to end it as the first part and pass it on to the public, and I will be continuing to edit the rest of it. There is so much of richness in the discussion when one comes to think of it that I should be doing it proper justice by breaking it into a couple of parts. So over and out for now from me, and I apologize to the listeners and also to Mr. Devinder Sharma for taking time preparing this first part. I should have done it about a month ago. I had been busy with too many things, but that's no good excuse. So I promise to take up the rest of the parts quickly enough, and I hope you'll like it. You're most welcome to comment on what you thought about this podcast, and you'll find it on my blog site at www.tonu.org, and you'll also find it in iTunes under podcast. If you search by my name, Tony Mitra, you'll come across this particular podcast. You can subscribe to it. It is free of charge. Thank you, and over and out.